one and all to another episode of Amy Talks. I'm your host Amy Jones, and today we will be exploring the best moments of each episode throughout 2022. Sit back and enjoy reflecting with me. My comeback episode of 2022 discussed cancel culture, which is where people are ostracised for something they've said or done. The main example I used for this episode was that of influencer and small business owner Polly Valdez, who had used racist and other horrific language on Twitter. Being cancelled has meant that the people working for her had left the company and more. Take a listen to what I had to say on the matter. Now on to the person who I mentioned in the introduction about who had been cancelled recently. This was literally last week, beginning of this week. It's from a shop, a small business called Sai Studio, and the owner, Polly Vadas, I don't know how you say that, has been exposed for having some absolutely horrific tweets. Obviously, I'm not going to mention any of them because they are highly, highly offensive. But if you want to go and see what those tweets are, there's a Twitter account called @PollyExposed. Who details every single tweet that she sent and what it what the language contains and all of that sort of thing. But she's made sort of racist jokes, you know, xenophobic, pro fox hunting, all of that kind of thing. And it's absolutely just horrific. The worst thing is she's my age. And I would have thought, for somebody who was my age, she sent one of those tweets when she was 17. When I was 17, even if I did have those views, which I must clarify, I do not, the last thing I would think is putting it on Twitter. Honestly, I'm absolutely shocked that she's done that and that she still kept them up. Like, if she'd truly kind of thought, oh God, you know, these tweets are still here, I personally what I would have done is deleted them a long time ago. But obviously those are entrenched views within her, so maybe she didn't want to delete them, because kind of people, that was how she truly thought. And I guess people obviously didn't know about that, and people have made various statements on like Instagram and Twitter and places saying, I will never shop with Polly and her business again, and I never will. The reason I'm so shocked about it is because I used to be a customer. I bought gifts for people from there, and just like, she seemed so nice, but obviously there was a different side to her that nobody knew. The business was hugely popular on Instagram. It had like 50,000 followers or something, and Polly was kind of the star of that. She was kind of the face of the business. It had products like washi tapes and journals and things like that, and people, it was very kind of the content from the page was very kind of relatable to people, so people could relate to that and then buy the products. So obviously people have been boycotting the brand in light of this news. What's made it worse though is that her mum got involved and has begun sending tweets to people kind of defending Polly and those views. And I just think, you don't need to be defending her. You need to sit down with her and speak to her about her views and how you think they're wrong. But obviously the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, so I guess her mum has the same entrenched views that Polly does. And it's all a bit shocking and quite a wake-up, really, I guess, because I kind of thought that she was really nice, but obviously she's got different views to those who shop with her and who think of her as a friend. So they're kind of distancing themselves from her, which I can completely understand. And people are, you know, undoubtedly pissed off and want a refund from their products, but I don't know how much it's going to affect Polly's business, because she came up with like a statement on Instagram on her private, on her story, which she then made private, and it reads, "I know that people have been disappointed in how long it's taken me to respond to all of this, but in all honesty, after getting things so wrong, I want to make sure that I didn't cause more harm to anyone else going forward. I also wanted to speak to my staff and apologise to them for bringing this into their workplace. I hope that nobody will direct any hate or abuse at them as a consequence of my actions, as they truly don't deserve that. I want to apologise also to my fellow creatives and small business owners that feel that your association with me has tarnished you, especially to those in the communities directly affected by my hateful speech. I hope in time we can rebuild our relationships, and I hope I can prove that I am no longer the person in those screenshots. I would also like to apologise to my customers, again especially to those who have been personally hurt by the words used in those old posts. You have shown me so much kindness, love and support over the years, and I will be forever grateful for that. I cannot express how sorry I am for letting you down. I can only say that I truly know better now, and I will strive to continue and learn and educate myself going forward. I know that these are just words on the screen, but please be assured that the actions I've talked about on here are commitments I will begin working on immediately. I am so incredibly sorry, but I am glad for this opportunity to be held accountable for my actions and do some good. I should have known better at the time, and I am deeply ashamed of the things I said, the attitudes I held as a teenager. I can only apologise and do my best to do better and be better in future. Thank you." And it continues, "As a follow-up to my story, I'd like to commit to actions over words going forward. I can only apologise so much, but I know that it's meaningless without putting change into action. I want to pay reparations to the people that I have hurt through those words. I will dedicate a set percentage of my profits going forward to charities such as Stop Hate UK and Stonewall to promote inclusive teaching in schools and in workplaces. I'd also like to use my platform going forward to shine a spotlight on up-and-coming designers, especially for marginalised communities, to help get their work out there and voices heard." The next episode was all about attending the Commonwealth Games in Birmingham, where they were being held for 2022. It was an amazing occasion and a week that I will never forget. In case you're interested, I went to see the athletics, table tennis and weightlifting. All the events were amazing, but it was very expensive. And the clip I'm choosing to highlight was my selection of tips for anyone wanting to see a big sporting event. So that was my games experience, my top tips for people who are going to an event like the Olympics or the Commonwealth Games or the World Champs, anything like that. Tip number one, be organised, because the ballot comes out probably a year, 18 months in advance. So you have to know what you want to see, apply for it, choose what category and band you want it in, because tickets are at different prices. Because say if you wanted like category A for swimming and you pay like £100 a ticket, you're more likely to get it than you are if you go for category C, for example. So it's really imperative, it's absolutely imperative that you are organised, you know what time the ballot goes on sale, you know what you want to see, you apply for those tickets, and then I think you hear back like a month or two later, and once you have those tickets, book somewhere to stay, because everybody who has an Airbnb or who has a hotel or these hotel chains, they know 3 or 4 years in advance that the Commonwealth Games will be coming. So as soon as you have those tickets, book a hotel, because the prices are extortionate anyway, but they're going to become even more extortionate as time goes on. So if you leave it until like 6 months in advance, you're going to be paying twice as much as you would have been if you'd booked it at the time. So that's that. And my second tip would be save some money. I didn't realise how expensive it was going to be. It's not a cheap week or few days or however long you're there, because you've got food to think about. You know, if you're having food at the arena, that's going to be expensive, because obviously they know it's a tourist trap, so they can put the prices up. Accommodation, any merch that you want. Like, I bought a shirt and a key ring, and it came to like £45, but because I have a blue light card, I was able to save 10%, very, very luckily, but a lot of people don't.
So that's expensive. Food in the venue, if you want. Yeah, I just mentioned that. Yeah, I just kind of drinks, all that sort of thing. Like, it's all just so expensive. So that would definitely be my second tip. And my third tip would probably be enjoy it, take in the atmosphere. Don't worry about, where to park and all that stuff. You've paid for all of that. So just worry about getting there and being kind of part of the atmosphere and enjoy it. It's one of those once in a lifetime things that you will always remember being at and going to. So just get involved and don't be afraid to kind of share things on social media, because you will look back on that day and look back in the future and think, oh, that was such a good trip.
Okay, I'll be honest. When I made this episode, I'd lost all interest in making my podcast and I definitely lost my confidence in front of the microphone. So I wanted to talk about it. I described how I'd been feeling and the comparisons I'd been making between mine and other successful shows. Listen to what I had to say. Okay, so on to the discussion for today. Now, what I meant by a crisis of confidence is that for most of this year, I've just kind of haven't, I've fallen out of love with the podcast. So maybe felt a bit burnt out, or, there was, I absolutely love presenting the show and, being the main face of it and interviewing people, but it is a lot of work and I do it all myself. That's partly because I like being in control and I don't like giving control over to other people for things, which is, well, I need to work on that, I think. Over the next couple of weeks, but I definitely feel that I haven't been as present on social media and other things that I would like to have been, and kind of my confidence in the show and the kind of topics that I was discussing has therefore kind of been an all-time low, really. The main thing, the kind of hardest thing for me anyway of the show is editing and keeping up with social media. Now, I'd love to hire a social media person, but this podcast isn't my full-time job. I have another job, so I don't, at the moment anyway, I don't have the money to hire somebody or kind of discuss a proposition with someone, because I can't afford it. It's that simple. If anybody wants to offer their services, for a cheap rate, please let me know. I'd be happy to discuss it with you. And also, between January and when I made my first episode about the cancel culture and now, so for example, when I made my episode last week, I've had a couple of jobs in between times. So obviously I've got my new full-time job now, but at my job in January I had days off so I could record and edit and do socials and all this sort of thing. I'm not complaining at all, but I have to coordinate my time now on weekends and bank holidays to be able to do it. That's why I try and schedule as much as I can in advance, so that, for example, on a Thursday when it comes out, I can't spend all day making graphics for it, because that's a personal thing, it's not a work thing. And another thing, as I mentioned earlier, this podcast isn't my job. So I don't get the money from sponsorships. I mean, if somebody wants to sponsor me, get in touch. But if I want to do an interview, or if I want to go somewhere and kind of record something with someone, that's out of my own pocket. So I'm more kind of less inclined to do it, I think. Also, when I think if you've been around here long enough, and you remember sort of 2018, 2019 time, when I interviewed lots of different people and I had like a two-part like Christmas special, basically. That's because I was unemployed at the time, and so content was at an all-time high because I had the time to do it. But now, obviously, things have changed, and I'm trying to fit, kind of shoehorn it around all my work commitments, which is quite hard, but I'm getting there and I'm falling back in love with it now, and I'm really excited to be creating content and be kind of happy to be creating episodes again. Because another thing is that I would create episodes, but in my eyes, it wouldn't be very good. So I kind of think, well, why would anyone like it? Why would anyone want to listen to me rambling on for 15 minutes? I mean, somebody might. But I kind of thought, well, why would anyone want to listen to me? You know, I kind of lost all that confidence I had, and I was comparing myself a lot to other podcasts who were bigger. But that's because they have sponsors and they've been consistently creating and doing video and TikTok and all these other things to be able to enable that growth. I didn't do that, which is my own, but it's partly my own fault, but also the kind of resources. They have the kind of resources that I don't. So, yeah, I was comparing myself a lot and kind of making, kind of saying, oh, well, why am I not doing that and why am I not doing this? Well, you know, everybody has their own journey with a project, whether it be whether you're just starting out or whether you're, you know, established. That's kind of up to you to make, really. But thankfully, I'm feeling a bit better now. As I mentioned, I was feeling a bit burnt out, I think, with all of the kind of decisions about all the social and, you know, all the content that I needed to create and all that sort of thing, because things are changing all the time. And trends are changing all the time as well. So I think I kind of got a bit overwhelmed with all of that and kind of didn't really have a clear view of what I wanted. But now I do. Also, as I mentioned, I wasn't creating episodes that I was happy with. So, for example, the one about learning to drive, like, I listened to that and I thought, I don't like it, so why would anyone else? So that obviously kind of compounded my issues and kind of made me think, well, if they're not going to like one of the episodes I've done, they're not going to like any of them. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting to think about the fact that, you know, the episodes that I enjoy, that I maybe don't think were the best, some people might really enjoy. Yeah, so hopefully I can create more episodes that I'm happy with and you're happy with and that you enjoy moving forward. Also, another thing, this is kind of for the future, really. I was reflecting on the interviews that I've done so far, which have been great and very, very insightful. Thank you to everybody who's agreed to do an interview with me. But I've interviewed people like Jackie Smith and Ian Dale and James Mates, but my kind of thought was, well, where do I go from here? You know, will my other guests be as intriguing as that? So I've come up with a list of people that I would like to interview, interesting people that I think the audience would be interested by. Obviously, I won't be sharing that. That is a private thing until the interviews come out or if they say yes or no. Now I promise not to leave it this long without at least checking in, make an episode saying, hi, I'm still here, I'm still alive, I will be making more. You know, not leaving it as long to kind of give you guys an update, because I can imagine it was a long 6 months without an episode and being kind of me being absent for so long has kind of damaged the podcast's reputation for weekly episodes and things like that. So I kind of hope to be more confident in the future and creating more episodes, even if, you know, they're not great. I don't think they're great. I'm going to publish them anyway because somebody might enjoy them. So for the future, as I just mentioned, more episodes will be coming. I have it all mind mapped. I have spreadsheets of people that I want to invite onto the show and kind of why they would be interesting and how you guys might react to them being interviewed by me. You know, I've got a whole kind of mind map of what I want to do with social and who I want, my kind of dream guest list. Obviously, I'm not going to share that and all of that sort of thing. In terms of social media, now I need to get a scheduling app, but I don't know which one to have. If anyone has any recommendations, can you please let me know on Twitter or Instagram or email, whatever, if you have an app that schedules things and that you can direct post Twitter and Instagram. I would be very grateful, because obviously, I use Hootsuite at the moment, and it's great, it's okay, but I think I need to get a proper one that businesses kind of use and all, maybe. I just need to face the cost of getting the premium version of Hootsuite and kind of tapping into its features, because I think there's so many features in the app that I don't use, and I need to kind of be able to use that. I was also thinking about possibly joining TikTok. Now, I know TikTok is a big thing. It was a massive, massive thing at the moment. But I'm not sure whether people will like my content. I don't know. I could just start and see what happens, I guess. Set up a TikTok account and put my republish some of my old content on there and see what happens. And then, you know, moving forward, you know, maybe one video per episode or something of me talking to you or talking to somebody. I definitely want to outsource a lot more because as much as I love being in control, I need to learn to give the control to somebody else. And that's going to be difficult, but I think it's for the better for next year because obviously things are going to get more intense at work and more projects and all that sort of thing. So I think being able to outsource it to somebody else would really help. So, yeah. And obviously looking forward into next year, I think, as I mentioned, there's going to be more of a focus on video. That's the way that the social media landscape is going at the moment. So I might have to get myself a little camera and record myself recording or, you know, interviewing people and being more present on video because as much as I don't want to, I guess I have to take a leap into the unknown in terms of the social media world and kind of be more present and show my face. Obviously more interviews and a few solo episodes. I've got a few, as I mentioned before, I've got a few dream guests that I want to tick off before sort of in the next sort of 6 to 12 months. Obviously I'm not going to mention who they are, but if you want to have any guesses, let me know. Learning to drive is one of the most valuable life skills one can gain, and passing your driving test, sadly, isn't as simple as it seems. In this clip, I recount my test experience and going the wrong way on the first direction the examiner gave me. With the test, it was very daunting, very daunting. But I had pre-booked the date from when I learned with my other instructor, and my new instructor had encouraged me to keep the date. I only needed, like, maybe 10 lessons with him, the second instructor, to be able to get me to my test, which was good. He said, I think your test's ready. And I was so proud. I remember it. Honestly, I remember it like it was yesterday. For some reason, the thing that really sticks out to me about that day is that it was the this morning wedding. I don't know why I remember that. It was on at the Albert Hall. And I don't know. Yeah, it's weird which things stick out at you on certain days, but anyway. So I got up and my instructor came to pick me up an hour before, which is quite common. And then they kind of make you drive to the test centre. Now for me, the test centre was about 20 minutes away, I'd probably say. And I remember driving down the road and we stopped and I tried to overtake a lorry. And he said, if you'd done that on your test, it would be an automatic fail. And I kind of went, oh my God. It was a lot. And he said, you know, it's one of those things that you're driving before you get to the test centre is shit, but when you get there, as long as you hold your nerve, you should be fine. We got to the test centre about half an hour early, I think. I hadn't really eaten anything because I was very hungry, obviously, because I was so nervous. And I remember going in about 10 minutes before my slot started. And getting, they kind of checked my license and my theory test paperwork and all of that sort of thing. And then I went into the test centre and all the kind of, what they called, examiners came by and picked people up. And I was the last person to be picked up. I felt so nervous. It made me even more nervous. I was like, oh my God, what is going on? I was like, is somebody going to come pick me up? but they did. Eventually, she was really lovely, my instructor, my examiner, actually. She was really kind. And so on the way, she asked me a couple of questions. I can't remember what the questions were, but I remember she had to, like, prompt me a little bit for one of them, which was fine, and I passed that, so I was happy. I knew the answer after I'd sort of been poked a little bit, sort of prompted. And we got in the car. And I remember I was really nervous and I started the car and we got going and she said, can you go right, I think it was, at around the roundabout or something. I went the wrong way, which is not helpful, but they say that if you go the wrong way but you go the right way about it, and if you do it in the right way, and you know the examiner's happy that you observed, you know, mirror signal maneuver and all that stuff, then it's fine. So it was fine. We got back on the road we needed. Then I know she asked me to pull over and stop a few times and then pull back out into the road. So that was fine. The weirdest thing though was the emergency stop, because I think I'd only ever done that once in my learning. Yeah, or maybe I hadn't done it at all, I can't remember. But I remember doing it, and she said, okay, Amy, if you slow down, we're going to do the emergency stop now. So she said, accelerate up to 30 miles an hour, and what we're going to do is when I put my hand up, you are going to stop. So I did, as I was told, and I passed. I did really well on it. Yeah, so I was happy with that. Then what did I do after that? Then I think we went around some more roundabouts, and I remember we went onto the dual carriageway. I'd never done dual carriageways in my instructor's car before, so I was a bit like, ah! But it was okay. My lane positioning wasn't brilliant, but to be fair, I'd never done it before, so I didn't know, you know, how to manage that, but I did okay. And have to say, the test went by so quickly. It's 40 minutes. It feels like 20. It's so short. And then I went back, and I remember she did all the paperwork and stuff, and I was like, oh my God, what have I done? And here's another thing. My maneuver was the front bay park. And to this day, I cannot remember if I looked around before going into the bay or not. And I thought, oh my God, I haven't looked around. I failed. Oh no. And then I spent the entire time thinking, oh my God, I failed. But then I thought, no. Get that out of your head, because you might be on your way to passing here, and you might just have, and your thinking that you failed might have screwed it up. So I got back to the test centre, and she did all her paperwork and marking and all that stuff. And then she said, oh, I'm going to pass you today. And I just remember being so happy. Like, I'm getting a bit emotional about it now, because it's something that it's a life skill that I've wanted to kind of gain for probably a good couple of years, and I did, and it was amazing to be able to say that I can now drive. It was really cool. Yeah, definitely good. I got 7 minors, which I'm quite proud of actually, because I didn't get too many. I think 15 is the most you can get in terms of minors. Yeah, if you get a major, you fail immediately, but you can get up to 14 minors without failing. So yeah, I was very proud. I called everybody in my family and said, I've passed, and they were so proud of me, and I was so proud of myself. It was really cool. My final episode of 2022 featured Megan Campbell, the founder of Turquoise Sky Custom Spirits. We discussed many elements of making spirits, but my highlight was hearing her discuss the fascinating history of alcohol. Here's some of the story.
I'll kind of give you some highlights of like my favorite aspects of alcohol history.
Okay.
So humans have been making alcohol pretty much since we settled down and started like, oh, hey, I think we can like make things grow in one spot. Like that's when we started making alcohol.
Yeah.
And one of the first things that we did, and this is why people will say that mead is the oldest beverage in the world, is if you take a honeycomb and you scrape out all the honey and you do your best, there's always going to be some left over.
Mm.
And one of the things that they would do to try to get the rest of that honeycomb is they would leave it in a bucket or a pot of water. Mm. And if you put honey and water together, you have to fight not to make it ferment. Like it is immediately like, oh, let's make some alcohol right now. So you leave that overnight and you've got it, you know, it starts bubbling and it starts tasting different. So that was kind of the start of human alcohol creation. And, you know, one of my favorite cultural aspects is for the longest time, people would, they would have these special stirring sticks that they would carve, their family designs in and things like that. And they would use that to stir the alcohol and to help create it. What they didn't know was that by doing that, they were creating this breeding ground for the yeast, the bacteria that helped create the alcohol. So families would get these reputations as like, oh no, you want to marry this woman. Her mom makes the most incredible mead and she's learned how to make it from her mom. And they've got this great recipe. Well, a big part of that was they were selectively breeding these strains of yeast without even knowing it.
It was almost by accident.
Exactly. Yeah. They were just like, well, this one works really well, and this family makes really great drinks. So let's keep it going. It started in the Middle East. It was taken to England. Once England got its hands on it, it started spreading out everywhere in their touch, which you might have learned in school is a lot of
Maybe.
places. Maybe came up once or twice. So they would, they would spread it and they'd go somewhere and they'd be like, hey, this is distillation. What do you guys think? And everyone was pretty universally on board with it. I think probably, oh, it's so hard to pick my favorite things. I love the story of tequila because I think it's really exemplary of how opinions change. So in England, as this was, as we were starting to get alcohol going, there was this sort of general consensus that wine is the best. It is the only good thing to drink. If you are rich, that is what you drink. Everything else is trash. And if you drink it, then you're trash.
That sounds like us.
And then that kind of spilled over to cognac. So brandy and cognac was in the same boat. Like, this is the best stuff. This is what you drink if you're educated. And if you drink something else, then you're trash. So, whenever England would go out, everyone would bring a certain amount of brandy and wine with them. And then they would run out because you can't just pick it up at the store. And they'd have to drink whatever the locals were making. And inevitably, they would all agree that it was trash and brandy's better and they're better in every way for drinking it. So that kind of thing is very common. And it's still common today, just like, everyone in the United States, everyone's like, well, bourbon's the best thing ever and whatever, tequila, like no big deal, or brandy, like who cares? It's just a thing that we do where we're like, our stuff is the best, no matter who you are or where you are. So tequila, when they started creating that, they basically immediately like copyrighted it, where they put in these international laws and they said, by the way, we're Mexico. This is tequila. Nobody else can make it ever. And at the time, everyone was like, okay, big deal, whatever. But in the industry now, it's a huge deal because
It
tequila can only come from this one little place and it's like peppered with agave plants. Like, it's not like it can get bigger. It's not this huge zone. So now they've, by doing that thing forever ago, by creating this regulation forever ago, they've caused this nowadays where we're like, oh, now I have to pay. I live in Arizona, so tequila's a reasonable price. I've been told in England it is not a reasonable price. Like,
No. I
yeah,
don't
like a cheap bottle
buy
of
it, but
tequila is probably at least $30.
Yeah,
Ounce,
probably.
whatever. Yeah. So it's little things like that. Prohibition, I think, is obviously a really exciting period in alcohol history. That's what everyone talks about. One of my most interesting tidbits that I learned about prohibition was, everyone's like, oh, it was America's great experiment. But it was happening all over the world.
It wasn't
Like
just in America.
America, Exactly. Like, we were the ones to go, no, we're doing it. We're going all the way. Like, let's go for it. And the rest of the world was in the same zone. And then they saw what happened in America and they were like, okay, just kidding. Like, no, that's not going to work. But one of the first experiments in prohibition was actually in France, and it related to absinthe. And that's, yeah, so that's still why we have this huge misconception about absinthe, is basically at one point, right, America sent over a bunch of grapevines, and they were like, hey, these are Native American grapevines. Check it out, France. Well, it turns out Native American grapevines had these tiny little bugs on them that almost completely destroyed the French winemaking industry. Like, brink of ruin, gone, dead. Like, every wine making grape in France was almost gone at one point, which obviously decimated everything. Like, everyone was like, oh my God, this is terrible. And during that time, when nobody could get wine and nobody could get cognac, absinthe sprung up. And it was kind of like, oh, here's this cool drink and it's fun and it tastes great and we're all drinking it. And it was like the hit. It was, everybody had to be drinking it. And then a couple years go by and the winemaking industry has figured out how to fix the bug problem. And they want to come back on the scene. But absinthe is as this huge stranglehold. Like, it's a, you know, there's, it's the green hour, it's like happy hour, but everybody drinks absinthe when they get off work at this exact time. And they just couldn't compete. So what the French wine industry did is they paid a couple of doctors and they looked at all the ingredients that go into absinthe, and they found this one. It's wormwood. And it contains a chemical called thujone. And I could totally be pronouncing that wrong, not a scientist. And so these doctors basically took a bunch of thujone and injected it into a mouse. And the mouse freaked out and it was not okay. And so the doctors went, hey, look, this wormwood does this to you. And that's why everyone is going crazy. And there were a couple of examples of violent attacks where people were drunk and did bad things. And they were like, well, that's what absinthe does. And it's because of this wormwood. And so they got absinthe banned in France and subsequently other places. So that was kind of the first big prohibition move. And it went pretty well. And that's why everyone, you know, that's why America was like, oh no, this is fine. Look, they did it in France. But it was basically the equivalent of like shoving a rat into a pile of caffeine. And then when it freaks out, being like, oh, well, this is why you shouldn't have coffee. Like, you know, it was totally like, no, that is not how it works. Like, this is not a reasonable, but I think that's probably the most interesting to me, because everyone always talks about like bootleggers and gangster wars and how, you know, all the different ways that it just did not go well for America. Oh, another fun one. Going back a little bit into history, I in the US, we were taught all about the Sugar Act of whatever, when the United States was like, well, we're not going to pay this ridiculous tax on sugar. And as a child, I was like, yes, that is perfectly reasonable. Like, why would you want to pay so much money for sugar? And I didn't even think about like why we needed all this sugar. Well, it turns out that they weren't just taxing like plain white grain sugar, the way that I think of it, you know, when I was a little kid. They were taxing molasses, which is the key ingredient in making rum. So when people, you know, when we started all these riots over the sugar tax, it eventually led to the Revolutionary War. That wasn't about putting sugar in our tea. That was about making rum in the New England states. I was like, that's a huge deal. Like, and it just never occurred to me to even think about why we would care. Like, why were all these grown adults like so upset over sugar? Like, they weren't.
That's
So
so interesting.
yeah, and there's so many little things like that where you're like, why would they make that decision? Why would they care so much? And the answer is alcohol, but you're never going to get taught that in school. They're not going to
No.
be like, well, wanting more booze made the American Revolution. Like, nobody's going to say
Yeah. No, of course
that,
not. No. That's it for 2022, folks. I hope you enjoyed this look back at all the amazing moments and guests from the past year. As we move further into 2023, I'm excited to see what the future holds and to continue bringing you the best content possible. If you wish to keep up with the show in the meantime, you can do so on Twitter at Amy Talks Podcast and on Instagram at amytalks.podcast. Follow the show on your favourite podcast platform, just search Amy Talk. Thank you for tuning in and see you soon. Bye.